Hello and welcome to the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm William Armstrong. I write reviews every week for the Hurriyet Daily News. And in this podcast, I talk to authors about a newly released book on Turkey and its region. This week I reviewed Out of Nowhere, The Kurds of Syria in Peace and War by Michael M. Gunter, published by Hearst. The book's title, Out of Nowhere, refers to the fact that before the war broke out in 2011, Syria's Kurds were barely heard of. The book describes how Syria went from being a sleepy backwater in the Kurdish struggle to a high-profile centre of Kurdish nationalism amid the fight against ISIS. You can find a link to my review of the book via my blog, as well as a link to an edited version of this interview with Professor Michael Gunter at the Hurriyet Daily News. I started by asking him about why the Syrian Kurds were, up until 2011, less heard of than Kurds elsewhere in the region.
Well, the Syrian Kurds were much smaller population and percentage of the total state's population in Syria than they were in Iraq, Turkey, or Iran. Also, unlike Iraq, Turkey, and Iran, there was no one contiguous Kurdish area in Syria, rather three non-contiguous areas, and that weakened the Kurdish presence for being heard in Syria. Also in Syria, there was no natural geographical area for a guerrilla safe house, so no guerrilla movements of Kurds ever developed in Syria like they did in the other states where Kurds were living. The Kurdish parties in Syria were tiny, minuscule, divided, which probably hurt Kurdish recognition in Syria. And also the Syrian government's suppression of the Kurds was horrific in Syria, and that certainly dampened the Kurdish recognition. And finally, the PKK, in return for receiving a safe house in Syria, implicitly returned the promise of keeping a damper on Syrian Kurdish unrest.
And after 1923, the Treaty of Lausanne, the Kurds were left famously as the world's largest stateless nation. And in your account, the policies of the Ba'ath Party after 1963 were particularly oppressive. In what ways did the Ba'athists suppress the Kurds in Syria?
Well, Decree 93, as it is known, classified a number of Syrian Kurds as ajanib, which meant foreigners. They weren't allowed to vote or own property nor work in government jobs.
And another that came from, that was based on Kurds that had come from Turkey.
But had been in Syria since 1925.
And that was used as a justification.
Yes, that these were not really Syrians. And also another group of Kurds were classified as Maktumin, which was even worse. That meant they were concealed. They legally did not even have an existence. They had no civil rights at all. So this Decree 93 was a notorious Ba'athist suppression of the Kurds. Another notorious Ba'athist suppression was the Arab belt along the borders with Turkey. Kurds expropriated from the border, expropriated from their land, and moved inland to isolate them from Kurds across the border. A number of other suppressive Ba'athist policies were taken. The notorious Muhammad Talib Hilal manuscript that termed the Kurds as some type of cancerous growth upon the Arab body politic was certainly popularized by the Ba'athist regime. And even more recently, a number of other suppressive actions were taken by the Ba'athists, such as not registering Kurdish names of Syrian children, banning Kurdish cultural centers. The Ba'athist Constitution of Syria defines Syria as a Arab socialist republic with no place for Kurds, and so on and so on it went.
And there's a paradox there as well, because at the same time as the oppression was going on, after 1978, Syria hosted the PKK, who were focused on Turkey. How did that dynamic work out?
Well, Syria hosted the PKK as a weapon to use against Turkey in the water wars and disagreements about the annexation of Turkish province of Alexandria from Syria in 1938. And in return for giving the PKK a safe house in Syria, the PKK implicitly promised to keep a damper on all Kurdish unrest within Syria. So it was a win-win proposition for Assad.
And that arrangement sort of solidified links that were already quite strong between the Kurds of Turkey and the Kurds of Syria. And today those links are expressed between the PKK and the Democratic Union Party, the PYD. So the PKK focused on Turkey and the PYD in Syria. Could you just go into some detail about the links between these two bodies?
Well, yes. In 1998, Turkey threatened to go to war against Syria unless Syria expelled the PKK. And so Syria finally expelled the PKK, leading to Öcalan's capture a few months later. So the PKK was abolished within Syria in 1998. However, within 5 years, the remainder of the PKK within Syria reestablished a new party called the PYD, which was barely tolerated by Syria for some time, but eventually as a tool to use against Turkey once the Syrian civil war began in 2011, the PYD was allowed to blossom within Syria.
And was the PYD using the same sort of camps that the PKK had in Syria? What was the continuity there?
Well, the PYD now is more geographically focused simply in the northeastern part of Syria. In PKK days, the PKK had a wider range of activities available to it in Syria, including the notorious Bekaa Valley.
And the head of the PYD, Salih Muslim, is today playing a delicate balancing act amid the ongoing Syrian civil war. He has contacts in both the regime and in the opposition, and he's trying to maintain the Kurds and the PYD's position in northern Syria. Could you just explain what that balancing act involves?
Well, that's true. The PYD consciously pursues a third path in the Syrian civil war because the opposition to Assad has no role for the Kurds to play independently. There's no guarantee of any Kurdish rights if the opposition wins. So why should the PYD support the opposition? Indeed, the regime has frankly given the PYD a little more than the opposition has, although certainly the PYD doesn't trust the regime. If the regime should win the war, it would almost certainly try to suppress the Kurds again. So the Kurds are consciously pursuing a third independent path between the two parties, the opposition and the regime, during the Syrian civil war.
And Salih Muslim himself has been arrested on a number of occasions before the war broke out, of course.
That's true. When the PYD was being suppressed by the Syrian regime. But once the civil war broke out, the regime saw the PYD as a useful tacit ally against the opposition, and Salih Muslim was brought out of exile and allowed to return to Syria, where to some extent there's tacit cooperation between the PYD and Syria, although Salih Muslim, whom I know personally, and he speaks good English, not perfect, but he speaks good, understandable English. Salih Muslim has made it clear that while he will cooperate with the regime to some extent in the interests of the Kurds, he has no intention of supporting Assad in the long run and calls for Assad's removal.
One of the main questions that people have when considering the Kurds of Syria in the last few years is the idea that there's these three cantons that are not connected in any way. They don't have this contiguous arrangement in northern Syria. So what does that do? How does that play out in the way that they administer their territory?
Well, that's a valid question. To some extent, this discontinuity has been alleviated. Two of the cantons now, Kobani and Hasaka, or Jazeera, are now united. And one thing that's exercising Turkey very much, the Kurds are trying to, in the Turkish viewpoint, unite these two united cantons with the third canton, Afrin or Kurda. However, I don't think anybody in the world seems to understand the democratic autonomy that the Syrian Kurds are trying to implement. This is a new strategy of Öcalan's on how to govern in a post-nation-state world. The nation-state is perceived as inherently oppressive, and democratic autonomy is a decentralized form of bottom-up government that ignores the traditional nation state and brings together different ethnic groups administering their own affairs along with gender equality and ecological concerns. Now that sounds too good to be true. It probably is. However, in theory at least, democratic autonomy alleviates the problems of non-contiguous Kurdish areas populated heavily by Arab minorities and other minorities like Christians and other religious groups. And all of these different groups, along with the Kurds, are supposed to be able to cooperate with each other in this decentralized democratic autonomy, bottom-up type of administration.
And in the book, you describe how that works in practice, and you express some skepticism about the practicalities of democratic autonomy. Could you just go into a bit of detail about why you think it's too good to be true?
Well, I don't completely dismiss it, but just as with when Lenin first came to power in Soviet Russia, he said, all we're going to do is administer things and the state will gradually disappear, because administration among the proletariat should be easy. And of course, the exact opposite happened. One of the most monstrously centralized bureaucratic states in history through the Communist Party. I think it is largely impossible to administer somebody through this theory, because the power is simply not there to hold together the different segments of society. And indeed, despite this theory of democratic autonomy, in practice, it is clear to me that what is holding Rojava together, the Syrian Kurdistan, is the power of the PYD and its brother organization, the PKK. In other words, despite this talk about democratic autonomy, in reality, it's a traditional military power of the PKK and PYD that is holding all this together.
And the nature of that PYD rule has come under some scrutiny of late, and it's been accused of ethnic cleansing and other war crimes, most recently by Amnesty International in a report last week. So what do you make of these suggestions, particularly considering that the PYD is a US ally in the anti-ISIS fight?
Well, I'm very disappointed in Amnesty International because, as you know, in general, this NGO plays a very important role in defending the rights of the individual against government suppression. But on this particular one, where the Amnesty International report issued on October 12th, of this month alleges forced PYD displacement and home demolitions. This is a very partial and distorted report that in no way does justice to the PYD's efforts to protect not only Kurds but Arabs against the depredations of the of ISIS. Now, of course, if you're fighting ISIS, there are going to be some collateral damage. But the PYD and its fighting units, the YPG, have gone out of their way to not kill or displace the population. And in some cases, of course, for the very good of the Arab population, it's been asked to leave during the fighting. But as soon as the fighting is over and the PYD occupies this area, it's invited the Arab population to return, and it has returned. And indeed, that's what democratic autonomy is all about, to give everybody, not just the Kurds, a right to self-administer themselves. And there is evidence that, yes, the Arabs are part of the administration of Rojava. And on the other hand, we all know that ISIS brags about how much it destroys the cities and murders the people that it disagrees with. So it is really, in my opinion, ISIS that is causing most of this damage and killing, and certainly not the Kurds.
And just to conclude, you completed the research for the book over 2 years ago, and obviously facts on the ground have changed very much since then. How do you assess the change in the situation since the book was written, and particularly, of course, the rise of ISIS?
Well, William, in very general terms, I'm pleased with how my work has held up. And although certainly my background analysis of the Syrian situation in Syria has held up very well. And even ISIS, which had been barely known to the outside world at the time my book was written, if you read my book carefully, you see that I have a deep respect for the threat that ISIS is presenting to the Kurds, although clearly I had no idea that ISIS was going to be such an existential threat. So if I were writing a second edition, of course, we would go into this in much greater detail, the ISIS threat. In my book, I spend much more time talking about the Nusra threat to the Kurds. And indeed, some authorities right now feel that in the long run, al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, may turn out to be worse than ISIS. But yes, ISIS certainly is something I did not consider, because it wasn't the threat it is now, and specifically the Kobani battle, which has been said to be the Kurdish Stalingrad. More recently, the new increased Turkish hostility and intervention into Syria is a whole new game here, where the Turks are seeing the PYD as a extension of the PKK, and the PKK-Turkish peace process broke down in July, and renewed war between the PKK and Turkey, which is spilling over into Syria now against the PYD. And maybe even more importantly, the new Russian intervention just the last month, which has the earmarks of being a game changer here in terms of eliminating ISIS. We shall see.
And how do you think the Russian intervention to basically support the Assad regime, it seems, how do you think that will affect the Kurds?
If the Russians go as far as possible and restore Assad to rule in Syria, of course, this would be negative as far as the Kurds are concerned. So we'll have to wait and see. Again, in the middle and short run, the Russian intervention is helpful to the Kurds, and the Kurds are even talking with the Russians about working together. In the long run, if the Russians completely restore Assad to power, this could be a real threat to the existence of the Kurds, Rojava.
Yeah, and there's also the question about the Russians not targeting ISIS and targeting the other rebels. How would that affect the Kurds?
Well, so long as Russia is not targeting the Kurds, who are other rebels, the other rebels, such as Nusra, is an enemy of the Kurds. Now, in just the last week or so, the Kurds have actually created a formal organization called the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is an alliance between the PYD/YPG forces and various moderate Syrian forces of Arabs, such as what is left of the Free Syrian Army and various Christian groups. And if the Russians begin to extend their targeting of rebel forces to these groups that are in alliance with the Kurds in this new democratic Syrian Democratic Forces alliance, then we could see some real problems for the Kurds in the Russian intervention.
That was Michael Gunter. On my WordPress blog, you can find a link to my review of his book called Out of Nowhere, The Kurds of Syria in Peace and War. There's also a link to an edited text of this interview and others at the Hürriyet Daily News. You can also subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Podbean, and SoundCloud. And if you liked it, please take the time to rate it on iTunes, which helps spread the word and make it easier for people to find the podcast. Meanwhile, thank you very much for listening. Tellidir, tellim anam, tellidir, tellidir amma.